Island, Crimes and Mysteries with Newells.
Hey guys, and welcome to another episode of Ireland Crimes and Mysteries. I want to thank you for joining me today, and if you're a returning listener, I want to say a big thank you for your continued support. If this is your first time listening to my podcast, welcome. It's great to have you on board. So without further ado, let's get started on today's story. Before we start, I just want to make you aware that some of the content covered in this episode may be upsetting to some listeners. Today's case takes us back to Kilkenny and to a small rural village called Winegap. Situated just south of Callan near the border of County Tipperary and just a 30-minute drive from Kilkenny City, Winegap was named for its location on a pass through the hill east of Slievenamon Mountain. Being a small village, there was a great sense of community there. So when the horror that we are about to speak about happened, this small, tight-knit community was left reeling. It is here that Sharon Whelan, aged 30, lived with her two daughters, Zara, aged 7, and 2-year-old Nadia. Sharon had been adopted into the Whelan family when she was 4 years of age by her parents, Christy and Nancy. The Whelans lived just off the main road into Winegap, and Sharon lived in a rented farmhouse about a mile away in 2008. Christy and Nancy were very involved in their granddaughters' lives, and Christy would bring 7-year-old Zara to school every day and collect her that evening. After collecting her at 8 a.m. from her mother's, she would get ready for school at their house, exclaiming, "Granddad, you're my taxi driver and Nanny is my hairdresser." Zara was a very bubbly child and loved spending time with her grandfather. When Christy would be tasked with putting up the flags for a local GAA match, it was Zara who would help him. In the run-up to Christmas 2008, Zara, having written her letter destined for the North Pole, was full of excitement and couldn't wait for Santa Claus to arrive on Christmas Eve. Nadia, at just 2, was still a little young to understand the magic of the upcoming holidays, but having the two little ones around made the run-up to Christmas a lively, fun-filled one for all the Whelans. Christy and Nancy had met in a dance hall in London called the Innisfree in the 1960s. The two of them worked for Wall's Meat Factory, but in different factories, so their paths had never crossed until that night at the dance hall. They would later marry and move back to Ireland and went on to have their daughter, who they named Jacqueline, who unfortunately would get sick and pass away just before her first birthday, crushing Christy and Nancy. They also had 2 sons named Paul and John, but the longing for a little girl never left Nancy, who was still grieving Jacqueline's death. This was when Sharon came into their lives. Initially just meant as a fostering, Christy and Nancy had spent 6 weeks getting to know Sharon at the foster home when they realised she also had a brother named David. Nancy, not wanting to separate the siblings, decided to take them both, with another sister, Linda, arriving a few months later. The Whelan house was a lively place to grow up. Sharon blossomed as she grew up into a lovely young girl who had lots of friends, her mother describing her as loyal. She loved her school years, and because she was such a people person, no one was surprised when she said she wanted to pursue a career in hospitality. In her 20s, Sharon became pregnant with Zara, with Nadia following some 5 years later. As I said, Zara was full of life at 7 years old. She played camogie and was a great runner, according to her grandfather, often exclaiming on her return to their house that she was bet and would shower at her grandparents' house and stay over. Christy holds fond memories of their many walks between his house and Zara's and their little chats along the way, describing her as an absolutely lovely little girl. Nadia, at just 2 years of age, was just starting to develop her own little personality. Christy and Nancy said Sharon was a wonderful mother, saying those children were her life. They never wanted for anything. That Christmas, Sharon had been busy in the run-up to the festivities. She wanted to make sure she had everything the girls had asked for. She excitedly told her mother on Christmas Eve that she had managed to get everything on their list And having paid all her bills, she asked her mother if she would not mind minding the girls so she and her sister Linda could go for a few drinks. She then said to her mother if they would call down on Christmas morning and they would all go to Mass together. Christy remembers dropping the presents, which had been stored at their house, down to Sharon that Christmas Eve once the girls were asleep. Not wanting to wake the girls, he turned off the car lights and pulled in at the entrance gate to Sharon's rented farmhouse. Sharon came to a window and he handed over the bags of presents to her, and he then carried a box containing a tricycle to the front door. His last interaction with Sharon as he walked back to the car was Sharon saying to him, "I'll see you in the morning." Early on Christmas morning, a knock came to the door and Christy went down to answer it. Little did he know that the person at the door was bringing news to them that was going to upend their lives forevermore. He opened the door to the news that Sharon's house was ablaze. Nancy and Christy tore down to the house, ringing their son John on the way. They could not believe their eyes when they arrived. They did not want to believe that Sharon and her two daughters were in the house, so Christy started checking the sheds to see if they'd taken refuge in there. Little did he know that Sharon, Zara and Nadia had already been removed from the house by neighbours, and unfortunately, there was no survivors. Thankfully, Christy was spared witnessing this by a quick-thinking emergency worker and was told the news that there was no one alive. He ran back to Nancy screaming that they were all gone. Nancy, in a panic, shouted, "Where are they all gone?" Christy simply replied, "They are all dead." Initially, in the early days after the incident, the family assumed it had been a tragic accident, thinking maybe Sharon had left a candle lighting, or with the season that was in it, maybe an electrical fault had caused the fire. It never even crossed their minds that a much darker explanation for the fire would be the reason. Everyone assumed it was an accident. But it was no accident, and the killer was out there. Detective Brian Murphy was stationed in Kilkenny in 2008, and despite not working on Christmas Day, he was on call as the crime scene examiner. He didn't expect to be getting a call on Christmas Day, as it was generally a quieter day. He was told he was needed at a scene of a fatal house fire in Winegap. He said he will never forget getting that call. He left his house around 11 a.m. and travelled to Winegap. When he arrived out at Sharon's house, the place was a hive of activity with Gardaí, fire brigades, paramedics and neighbours. The fire had already been extinguished as the call had been put out earlier that morning by neighbours. Two brothers who had been bringing in cattle had spotted the house alight, rang the fire brigade and went to try and help while they waited for them to arrive. They all knew Sharon lived there with her two young children. They attempted to get in the front door but were beaten back by the flames. One of the brothers knew what room the children would be in as he was a plumber and had done work for Sharon in the past. They went to the back of the house and broke the window into the children's bedroom, which miraculously was the only room of the house that the fire had not reached yet. He jumped through the window and recovered Nadia first, then Zara. While in the room, he tripped over Sharon's body, which was laying on the ground with a blanket over her. He removed her body and passed her to the people waiting outside the window. This man had gone to school with Sharon, and his act of bravery would prove very important as the investigation pressed on later. Jim Ling was a detective sergeant stationed in Kilkenny and was on duty on Christmas Day 2008. While attending Mass that morning, he also got the call to go out to the house in Winegap, being told that there was a fire there and that there had been fatalities. He rushed to the scene. He described the scene he had met as horrific. As he arrived at around 10 a.m, ambulance crews were just about to leave with the remains of Sharon and her two daughters, as they had just been pronounced dead. Local Gardaí had been on the scene for a few hours, as well as the fire service, who had put the blaze out. Detective Ling said that at this stage the house was totally gutted, except for this one room which had been saved by the firefighters. He said that the fire chief was still there and that they had fought hard to save as much of the house as they could, but the fire was so intense this was not possible. But saving this one room would prove imperative to the investigation. The scene was then preserved by the Gardaí once it was deemed safe by the fire services for the investigation as to what exactly had happened there that night to cause such a fire, which had left one adult and two innocent children dead. Everyone who had attended the scene that early Christmas morning was left in complete shock after seeing something so horrific. It didn't matter whether you were one of the emergency responders or a neighbour. Everyone was affected by what they had witnessed. Gardaí initially also thought that they were dealing with a tragic accident, but this would soon change. Detective Ling and Murphy, with all their years of experience, knew not to jump to conclusions and to keep an open mind. The neighbours who had removed the family from the house all noticed that Sharon's body was stiff when they moved her, but Zara's and Nadia's bodies weren't. In fact, they were still warm. This was also noted by the paramedics who had worked on them at the scene. This, of course, would suggest that Sharon had died some time before the girls. But why were they all found in the same room? Plus, Sharon had been found with a blanket placed over her. This raised suspicions amongst the detectives. The remains were removed to Waterford University Hospital, where a local pathologist carried out the initial postmortems that following morning. He discontinued the postmortem when it became clear to him that Sharon had died prior to the fire, as he felt this warranted looking into at a higher level. Sharon had no evidence of smoke inhalation in her lungs, meaning she would have had to have been already deceased before the fire started. Whereas Zara and Nadia had smoke in their lungs, meaning they had died from smoke inhalation caused by the house fire. They basically went to their beds that night, all excited for what Santa would bring, but never woke up. It was also noted by him that Sharon had bruising to her neck. He rang the Gardaí to let them know his findings. Professor Mary Cassidy, the state pathologist, was tasked with carrying out further postmortems on the remains of all three victims. This would take a few days as she did a very comprehensive examination. She concluded that Sharon had died by strangulation. She also had many defensive wounds to her body. Her death had been a violent one. Sharon had fought for her life. This was now a murder investigation, and following Professor Cassidy's findings, it was officially announced as one. Despite the fact that no evidence could be gathered from the house as it had been gutted, Sharon was able to tell her story of what had happened to her from beyond the grave. The investigation initially focused on Sharon's last known movements in the week and days leading up to this tragedy. House-to-house inquiries were carried out, and the investigating officers also spoke with her family and friends, as well as reviewing CCTV and examining her phone records, as they tried to build a picture of what Sharon had been doing in the days previous and who she had interacted with. Her family were shocked to find out that Sharon and her two beautiful little girls had been so callously murdered. They couldn't understand it. Sharon had been a popular lady with many friends. They could not believe anyone would want to harm her, let alone murder her. As I said, the fact that those brave neighbours had risked their lives and entered the house and recovered the remains of Sharon, Zara and Nadia intact, this would prove crucial for the investigation. As well as the fact that the girls' bedroom had been saved, despite the rest of the house being gutted, meant that not all the evidence was destroyed in the fire. If they'd not secured the remains or that room, it would have been near impossible to come to the conclusion that they had all been murdered. One very important piece of evidence that would have been lost if Sharon's remains had not been saved was found during the post-mortem. Along with the fact that the findings told the investigating officers that Sharon had been strangled, it also revealed that she had been a victim of a violent sexual assault, a fact that devastated the Whelan family even more. A DNA profile was able to be obtained from a semen sample taken from Sharon's body. This was a major break in the case, and efforts now focused on matching up this sample with whoever was at the scene. Meanwhile, The funeral mass of Sharon, Zara and Nadia took place in St. Nicholas's Church, Winegap, on New Year's Day. The cortege left Molloy's funeral home in Callan and made its way to Winegap, with people lining the route along the way, while hundreds more waited to pay their respects and offer their support to the Whelan family at the church. The family saying they were so grateful for all the support. Sharon, Zara and Nadia were then laid to rest together in the adjoining cemetery. The investigation had received a major boost with the DNA profile, but now the task was to find who matched with this profile. If they could not be found, it ran the risk of stalling the investigation. Adding to the fact that there was a growing sense of unease amongst the community that the killer was still walking free, he could be walking free amongst the local people of Winegap. Everyone who had had access to the house, including the Whelan family, the neighbours who had retrieved the bodies, other neighbours and emergency personnel who attended the scene were asked to give samples, as well as fingerprints, in order to eliminate them. Even the local postmen, oil delivery men, anyone who had had access to the house were asked. The initial number of consented samples was around 80. The samples were sent to the forensic laboratory in batches of 10. The first sample came back negative, but the second sample came back with a positive match. The positive match was from a local man named Brian Hennessy. Brian was 23 years old. He lived only up the road from Sharon's parents, with his own parents, trained with the local GAA club, and worked as a sub-postman in the area. He would have delivered posts to Sharon's house. Gardaí had also become suspicious of him prior to the match, when some of the locals told him that he'd been asking around, had the fire brought down the roof. He had been in Guiney's pub in Winegap on Christmas Eve, the night the murders took place. The Whelans were made aware by their liaison officer that an arrest had been made. When they were told who had been arrested, they were completely shocked. Winegap is a small community where everyone knows everyone, and Sharon's family knew the Hennessy family. Nancy had known Brian Hennessy's grandmother, who she said was very good to them in the past. She said Brian's grandmother was distraught when she found out what her grandson had done and told Nancy she was ashamed to say hello to her. But Nancy reassured her that they held no blame for anyone else, only, as Nancy put it, the hands that had done it. It was incomprehensible to them that it was Brian who had committed such an evil act on their daughter and granddaughters. He lived amongst them. They knew him. He delivered their post. They would have had lots of interactions with him, but would never have suspected him. Sharon also knew him, but not as well, just in passing. What was even more deplorable after everyone found out who had been arrested was the fact, on reflection, that Brian had carried on like nothing had happened after he carried out his heinous act. There was no change in his behaviour whatsoever. His arrest took place at his home on the 15th of January 2009, some 3 weeks after the murders. He must have known when giving the initial DNA sample that there was a strong possibility that the Gardaí would come knocking. This match placed him at the scene and confirmed that he and Sharon had been together that night. But under what circumstances? Now it was up to the detectives investigating to prove that not only had Brian been at the scene while Sharon was still alive, but he was also responsible for all that followed. Detectives Ling and Murphy were tasked with interrogating Brian Hennessy. Despite the DNA match, they would need more to prove murder. Brian Hennessy had 3 weeks to come up with a story. He came across as calm and composed following his arrest. He probably thought he had the upper hand. As I stated earlier, he had shown no signs of his crime prior to his arrest. He had sat down to Christmas dinner with his family, going back to work, socialising in the local bar, even attending the funerals of Sharon, Zara and Nadia. His family, when interviewed, said they had noticed nothing different about him at all. Initially, once he became their prime suspect, an investigation into his movements on the day of the murders took place. It was crucial to know everything he had done in the run-up to the vicious crime. The detectives wanted to nail down a timeline that coincided with the murders. The local community were again questioned to see if they had any interactions with him. CCTV footage was analysed. All avenues were pursued. It was established that after he finished work on Christmas Eve, he went out with his friends to celebrate the festivities. After starting early in the day, they went to various pubs in Kilkenny and another in County Tipperary before he ended up in Guiney's pub. By this time, Brian had consumed a lot of alcohol. His friends said he was in good form but had a lot of drink on board. One of his friends told Interviewing Gardaí that Brian had said to him at some point during the day that he was going to have sex that night. Detectives Ling and Murphy held back on revealing the DNA match to him until they heard his side of the story. I'm sure he was wondering why this was not mentioned, as he probably assumed that this was why he'd been arrested in the first place. Initially, he denied he had ever been up to the house, but after a while finally admitted he had, but said he'd been invited up and went on to say he had consensual sex with Sharon in the room where the girls were asleep. Of course, detectives knew that this was a ploy on Brian's behalf to explain away his DNA. He had plenty of time to come up with a story after all. They also knew Sharon would not have invited him in on Christmas Eve, a man she only knew as an acquaintance, while her two girls slept in the house. Despite this, Brian remained steadfast in his claims that he had nothing to do with their murders, and getting him to confess was proving a difficult task. Detectives decided to present him with more evidence. They put it to him that it had been noted by the neighbours who recovered the bodies and the paramedics that Sharon's body was stiff, while the girls' bodies were not, meaning Sharon had died much earlier than the girls. On hearing this, Brian became agitated and upset, according to Detective Ling, finally admitting he strangled Sharon, saying the reason he did was because Sharon had threatened to tell people they had sex, including his girlfriend. But he said when he left, the girls were still alive. He refused to admit he had started the fire. The detectives had more work to do. He had told detectives that after he left the pub, he went back to get his jacket. Then he made his way to Sharon and was back home around 3 a.m. But his mother had a different version of events in her statement to Gardaí. She said he did not return home until around 7 a.m. and she was sure of this as he had no keys to get in and she had to leave him in. So where was Brian in those missing hours? When detectives put all this information before him, he knew the jig was up. He admitted he was at the house for some time after he had killed Sharon, trying to figure out what he would do. After he admitted he killed her in the kitchen, he said he brought her back down to the bedroom. It was then he decided to burn the house down. He claimed to detectives he didn't know why he took this course of action, but I think we can assume he thought he would get rid of the evidence and walk free. Which is very nearly what happened, only for the quick actions of the neighbours. He proceeded to set several fires around the house, not giving one thought to the little girls asleep in the bedroom, before he left and returned to his life and continued on as normal. The detective said he remained calm and detached for the majority of the interviews, until the third interview, when the evidence of his mother contradicting his story was put before him, as well as the evidence that Sharon was dead long before the girls. He did get upset then, but they said he never showed any real emotion. Detective Murphy believes the only reason he set that fire was to cover up what he had done, saying, he knew where she lived. He knew she was a vulnerable person. He walked from the pub to her house. He only went there for one reason, to take advantage of the fact that Sharon was on her own in the house. And to cover up this awful deed he had committed, he decided he would set the house on fire, knowing that two children were in there and likely to die as a result of the fire as well. The theory was that Sharon was killed sometime between 2 a.m. and 4 a.m, giving Hennessy over an hour to decide his next move. He set at least two, if not more, fires around the house, The main fire was set on top of a washing machine in the kitchen, where he set alight some clothes that were on top of the machine. Brian had plenty of time to just walk away after he had killed Sharon, but he chose a far more sinister option. He then went home, spent Christmas with his family and girlfriend, went out with his friends, not to mention going to the funeral. What kind of a person can continue on as normal after doing what he had done? The detective said that once he came clean, he did show remorse, but whether it was genuine or not, they could not say. He was charged with the murder of Sharon, Zara and Nadia, as well as two counts of criminal damage at a special sitting of the Kilkenny District Court, and remanded in custody to Cloverhill Prison to await trial. This brought a small bit of comfort to the Whelan family, that somebody was being held accountable for the senseless loss of three very precious members of their family. They hoped justice would finally be served. It was very hard for them coming face to face with him in court. It made them angry and upset. Sharon's brother John said seeing him that first time took him to a bad place. He felt numb. All he could see, he said, was this pathetic thing sitting in a chair that was after destroying his family. He said all he wanted to know is why. Why he had made that choice. But he said they had great support in the court that day. There was a big media interest in the case, as well as the wider public, who were stunned and aghast that this had happened to a mother and her two beautiful innocent little girls. So in the trial, which was set to begin in the Four Courts on the 17th of November 2009, there was a huge anticipation amongst the public as to how it would all play out. Everyone hoping that the person responsible would be held accountable for their actions and punished accordingly. All the Whelan family were at the Four Courts that day. This was going to be a very hard day indeed. But they wanted to be there. This was for Sharon, Zara and Nadia. After much anticipation, there was disappointment, as after the jury was sworn in, the judge adjourned the trial until the following day. Once again the following day, all the Whelans made their way to the Four Courts, ready to face whatever was thrown at them for their three girls. Coming face to face again with Brian Hennessy was no easier the second time around. While in the waiting room, John said he could see Brian Hennessy off in the distance, in his suit, chatting to his own family with a few guards around him. But this time seeing him, John felt different to that day he first laid eyes on him in the court in Kilkenny. They now knew more details about how Sharon had died and all that she had suffered before she had died. He said this time the overwhelming feeling he had was anger. Anger that he was just sitting there, calm as you like, chatting to his family, like he hadn't a care in the world. He was angry also for his parents, that they had to sit there in such close proximity to Brian Hennessy. He couldn't understand how this was allowed to happen. The trial, which was due to start at 11 a.m, was delayed. This only added to the anxieties of the Whelan family. Then it started to filter through that there was possibly going to be a plea and that negotiations were taking place. Eventually they were all called into the courtroom. The Whelans sat down with Brian Hennessy's family a mere two rows ahead of them. The trial then began in front of a packed courtroom, and to the shock of everyone present, the court was told that Brian Hennessy had pled guilty. The Whelan family couldn't believe it. They couldn't understand that he'd waited until the 11th hour to plead guilty. Why, was all they could think. They wouldn't have to wait long to find out. Hennessy had pled guilty to three charges of murder. This was a great relief to the family. But then the court heard that the charge of rape against Brian Hennessy was going to be dropped. This was a major blow for the family and Gardaí, as despite Hennessy saying it was consensual, no one believed that, and the post-mortem evidence told another story. It had shown that Sharon had been a victim of a violent assault. It was a bitter pill for the family that this charge was not being brought against Hennessy. The detectives investigating felt Sharon had died because he was afraid she would tell his girlfriend what had happened. but he kept insisting he hadn't raped her. Despite all the evidence there was going to be no punishment for Hennessy when it came to that charge. The only bit of cold comfort for the family was the fact they had been spared the ordeal of a trial, not having to sit there and relive everything all over again. Despite the fact they were swindled out of the rape charge, at least he had pled guilty to 3 counts of murder. So that day, which was meant to be day one of the trial, it had suddenly turned into a sentencing hearing. And even though the family were spared the trial, they would have to sit and listen to details of the crime that would have been very unpleasant and upsetting for them. No detail was spared of what Sharon, Zara and Nadia had gone through that night. This must have been so traumatic for the family. John again said it was the hardest thing they ever had to endure. Before the sentence was handed down, John went up to read out the family's victim impact statement. You could hear a pin drop as he made his way to the witness box. Brian Hennessy sat there with his head down while John read his statement to the court. Despite his nerves, John zoned out the rest of the courtroom and focusing his statement at Hennessy, he wanted him to know the damage he had done. He began to speak. He told him his acts were inhumane and ruthless. He spoke of the effects these acts had had on all of the family and continued to have on them. He said he couldn't put into words the pain, grief and destruction he had brought upon them. John made it clear to him that it was obvious to everyone that human life meant nothing to him, killing a defenseless mother and her 2 beautiful girls. He went on to say that it was beyond belief that anyone with any humanity or conscience could contemplate, never mind carry out such an act of pure evil. He described Sharon as a wonderful mother to her 2 gorgeous girls. Despite her struggles as a single mother, they wanted for nothing. He said the 3 of them were the centre of his parents' world, and you, Brian Hennessy, took that away. He spoke of how proud Zara was to help her grandfather put out the flags at the club prior to a hurling match and her love of camogie. She was due to make her communion the year she died. He told Brian he had taken away every joyous occasion the girls had to look forward to in their future. He described Nadia as a beautiful child full of life and mischief, and despite her recent diagnosis of autism, she was so loving and affectionate to everyone. He went on to say that Christmas no longer exists for the family. He described it now as a time of loss and profound grief, and not the joyful, peaceful time of the year it was before. He said Sharon and her 2 girls loved Christmas, and that Sharon was all excited to have everything ready for the girls that Christmas Eve. She had excitedly rang her mother 2 times to say they were asleep, before a 3rd call to say her dad could come down with the presents. That was the last time her mother heard her voice and a sleep that those little girls would never wake up from. He described how Sharon's mother and father now walk the short distance to the graveyard every morning and evening, saying it's all they have left. Their pain is unbearable. He told Brian Hennessy that he was the cause of all this pain. He finished off by saying he, as well as the rest of the family, hope that he will have a very long time to realise and be haunted by what he had done. He said it's the family's wish that he serve every day of his sentence, because the family will certainly serve every day of theirs. And with that, John returned to his seat. The judge, Justice Barry White, asked Brian Hennessy to stand up and he addressed him directly. He spoke of the devastation he brought to the family. He talked about how Zara and Nadia went to bed eagerly awaiting Santa's arrival, but never got to wake up to their Christmas presents that morning. Judge White himself was so obviously horrified by the brutality of the crime. He went on to sentence him for the murder of Sharon to a mandatory life sentence. For Zara's murder, he also handed down the mandatory life sentence. And finally, for little Nadia, he handed down the mandatory life sentence. He directed the court that these sentences for Zara and Nadia would run concurrently, which means served at the same time. But in a shock move, he went on to say that Hennessy should serve those sentences consecutively, meaning one after the other, to the life sentence which he had handed down for the murder of their mother Sharon. In other words, Brian Hennessy had been handed two life sentences to be served one after the other, back to back. Everyone in the courtroom was shocked, including Brian Hennessy, but Judge White felt that the crime was so brutal that it necessitated such a hard sentence. The Whelan family felt the sentence was just and left out a sigh of relief. But the comfort they felt in knowing Brian Hennessy had been put away for a very long time was short-lived. An appeal was put forward by Hennessy's legal team. By December 2010, the sentence had been overturned and he would now serve all three sentences concurrently, meaning only one life sentence. This was a major blow to the Whelan family, John describing it as diminishing two lives. An average life sentence in Ireland is approximately 20 years for murder, but a lifer can apply for parole after serving just 12 years, and it's at the discretion of the parole board then to decide if they are fit to be released or continue to serve their sentence of life. If you are refused parole, you can reapply every 2 years, which means for the families of the victims, they have to relive their horrors every 2 years, writing letters to the parole board, which the perpetrator is allowed to read, I might add. Then they have the anxiety of the wait to see if the parole will be granted or denied. If granted, a whole new horror begins for them, knowing that the perpetrator is free, while their loved one will never have that luxury. The whole system seems very geared in the perpetrator's favour and not the family of the victims, which seems like a very unjust system. The family of Sharon, Zara and Nadia will never forget that Christmas morning in 2008 when their lives were so callously turned upside down, never to be the same again. All because of the actions of a depraved man who took advantage of a woman he knew was vulnerable for his own satisfaction, and then proceeded to try and hide his crimes by burning her house to the ground with her two young daughters inside. It is beyond comprehension. And now 15 years later, they have to deal with the fact that this local man could soon be free and could possibly be back in their community. This is an unbearable sentence for the Whelan family and a far more damning one than Brian Hennessy would ever be afforded with the way our justice system is at present. No amount of reform of character that we hear about regularly when talking about sentence lengths can trump an adequate life, meaning whole life, for a crime so heinous as this. May Sharon, Zara and Nadia rest in peace. And as the Christmas season approaches, I would ask you to spare a thought for the Whelan family. So guys, that's it for today's episode of the Ireland Crimes and Mysteries podcast. Again, thanks for your listenership and don't forget to subscribe to the show and hit that auto download so you never miss an episode. Until the next time, keep your eyes open and your mind curious. This podcast has been compiled from information gathered in the public sphere, like news articles, documentaries, and open source material that can be found on the web. Everything in this podcast is alleged unless a conviction has taken place.
You've been listening to Ireland Crimes and Mysteries with Nules. Join us for another episode coming real soon.